Okay, this is the intro of the podcast, Mum. So the other day I did the podcast about anencephaly,
yeah,
that birth defect.
Yeah.
And I said that they look like little squashed frog children.
I don't like it. I think it's very... It's just horrible. If I had a baby like that and I knew someone was speaking and saying derogatory things like that, I'd be absolutely mortified. I think it was a horrible, horrible thing to say.
Because you think it's too cruel. It's yeah, too, it's, there's not yeah. enough humour in it.
No, there's not enough humour in it. I don't find that humorous at all. I just, no.
What
I
about
don't like
the fact...
I don't like it when people are saying what other people look like. People are lovely in their own right. And if...
Well, even if you've got no brain?
Yes.
You're still
because
lovely.
That is your child. You've given birth to that.
That?
No, I didn't mean... You're taking words out of context now. You've given birth to your baby, boy or girl. Whatever is wrong with it, you're gonna... You have instant love. You've never had children, you don't know. That love for a yeah. child is very...
So you think it's because there's a bit of a distance between... Like having me and a baby, for instance, me and having children. I don't know that automatic love.
You don't know that, and nobody knows that until they've gone through it.
What about the fact that I said it could be used as a vase?
Well, that's just bloody horrible, isn't it, you stupid arsehole? I mean, that's just, well, that's not funny. In my eyes, that's not funny.
Did you get a little glimmer of laughter
no,
in your stomach?
No, I know we have talks with each other about different things, and we do, between us, have little jokes about things. But no, that, I just found it horrible.
Just offensive?
Yes, it's
ugly.
Horrible.
Okay. Well, but I said it's an ornament. I refer to it as an ornament. What do you think of that?
It's just bloody disgusting, isn't it? And it's not funny.
It's not funny. It's not... This is why I said it. It's imagining that reaction. It's not even about the baby. Like, there's nothing funny about a baby
no,
that's
not.
Been born
I don't,
with such
well, yeah, but I don't
critical
find that humour. I don't find that humour when people do are sick, in my eyes.
Well, you think
like
it's a bit sadistic because you're laughing at someone... You're laughing at someone being, like, what you're reacting like you just reacted.
Yes,
that's what you find funny.
Yes. No, I don't find it funny.
No, that's what I find funny is, like, imagining you react to it like that. It's not even about the
baby.
But
why would you even say it? Why would you even think it or say it, well, it about this gorgeous little person that's just
little
been
blob.
Born?
Little
not
blob.
Not a little blob little, at all. No, he's... No.
Gorgeous.
No, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
What a gorgeous little blob you've given birth to there. That, he's got wonderful blob.
I don't find it funny, Liam.
All right, okay.
No, sorry. Goodbye.
Boom, and welcome to this week's episode. That was me rightfully getting reprimanded by my mum. I spoke a bit flippantly about anencephaly last week. I regretted it. Felt a bit mucky as a result of it. But it's like the theory of humour that we talked about before, and the driving motivation behind a dead baby joke isn't to laugh at a dead baby. It's to laugh at the butt of the joke are the sanctimonious people, or people who tend to sentimentalise mental illness and mental defects, etc. But like I've said before, that when I do my debut Edinburgh Hour, to complicate the image of a comedian as a fun one-note personality, I want to forge a bond of trust between me and the audience and build up some good feeling and... What's the word I always use that I'm looking for? Good feeling and goodwill, I suppose, yeah. Generate enough goodwill in the room that people enjoy my company and want to spend this time with me and want to go on this journey with me. But then in the final 5 minutes, say something so hateful, so irredeemable, that it completely eradicates any potential for career growth. Totally scorched earth. I said, what can I do for it? Like, punch a baby. Punch a dog. But then there's part of you that thinks, like, the dog is, that's just really sad. the dog doesn't have any concept of what's going on or why you're inflicting pain upon it. But with the baby, because it is human, there's a little part of you that thinks he might have brought it on himself. Very vindictive baby. Spiteful little baby. Spiteful little fucking baby he was. Very spiteful. Didn't like his aura. But then, yeah, reading this book about arguments about abortion, quite a heavy episode, personhood, morality and law. It says those of us who have little close experience with such people can be profoundly unaware of the many ways in which they are able to share in quintessentially personal human life, notwithstanding their disability. So people have extreme cognitive impairment. If we don't have any exposure to that, like I've never met a baby with anencephaly, but I have lately been looking after people with extreme learning difficulties and cognitive impairment, and you realise how you can develop relationships that like transcend language if there's someone who their capacity of language is limited. And it says one lesson from these sorts of critiques is that the cognitively impaired human being who cannot relate to others on levels higher than that of an ape might very rarely, if ever, be a reality. So we assume someone who's in a vegetative state that they're at that point, you know, their evolution has they've regressed back to the ape-like state. Thus, it is, but this isn't the case, is what it's saying. That is very rarely, or if ever, actually a reality. Thus it is that writers about cognitive disability, like Eva Kitte, whose own daughter suffers from severe mental disabilities, are often eager to enlighten us on the minutiae of everyday life with such persons and the myriad ways in which they can and do interact with other human beings on an interpersonal plane far above that which is possible for non-human animals. That's beautiful. I mean, I that's incredible. And I've ordered her book and I really look forward to reading it because I want to do the same thing. We've probably got different approaches. I mean, Eva Kitte isn't talking about shoving bars of soap up her ass as punishment or getting punched in the face in a pizza parlour by a brother because I was wearing a hat or when I was groomed-ish. Not groomed, I mean, I was 16, but got sucked off from Southend Seafront. Went through a kind of depersonalisation. So I saw an unaccompanied dog while I was getting sucked off. And I locked eyes with the dog. Dog locked eyes with me. And I thought, don't go, old boy. For the love of God, do not go. So something a bit problematic about that sexual relationship. It was consensual. It wasn't illegal. But it was... I mean, the threshold for illegality, we were very close to it. I mean, I was 16, she was quite a bit older. And then it talks here about the gradualist thesis. There's a punctualist thesis and the gradualist thesis. And the gradualist thesis, which holds that no sharp borderline exists between the absence of moral personhood and its attainment. I noted that on one reading, the crux of the conception threshold argument is that personhood is not a property which is attained at all, but that is just always present in personhood possessing creatures throughout their existence. Thus, human beings must always be persons from conception. And pro-choice people will maybe take umbrage with that. I mean, I've said there's a point where you're just a yogurt that can blink. I mean, if in theory you gave birth to that, I mean, the family photos would be a nightmare for starters. You know, you're putting your arm around your yogurt. The photographer just thinks it's a bit schmutz on daddy's lapel. Wipes away your son. Goodbye, yogurt. I'm wiping you away. Goodbye, yogurt. I'm wiping, wiping, wiping you away. One, and in this book, arguments about abortion. I actually bought this for research. You know, I don't just want to be flippant referring to anencephalitic children as a vase, I think I said at one point. So one question for advocates of personhood. From conception. So personhood from conception, the gradualist argument, is what morality dictates in the event of an anencephaly diagnosis during pregnancy. Conventional moral thinking undoubtedly takes such a scenario to be one of the most readily justified abortions. So when it comes to justifying an abortion, someone who's got anencephaly, and that you clock that in a prenatal screening. Hey, there's an argument for it here. So it said that I can't find it. However, this claim will simply not be true. So someone might claim that. Claim that even if the fetus's moral status is equal to that of a person, the fetus may well have interests rooted in its own well-being, in not being born and living a life burdened with disability. I mean, and how much more burdened can you get than having no brain? So you will stop you get from getting neck ache. It'll stop you from getting neck ache. Or you could use your head as a pencil case. Novelty pencil case. Nah, sorry. We'll get on to that in a minute. But it says, the human being cannot survive for long outside the womb in any event. So refraining from abortion is not in the interests of sustaining life for any length of time. Whereas procuring abortion at the earliest stage possible is clearly in the interests of the pregnant woman and possibly others. On the assumption that abortion amounts to homicide, which I don't believe, however, it is not clear that the terminal diagnosis of the fetus, future infant, is sufficient to justify abortion. The direct killing of another person is not permitted on the ground that the person has little time left to live, and that ending his life even sooner will spare someone else additional emotional distress. Consider a parent whose child is terminally ill cannot request that the child's death be sped up to spare himself the emotional turmoil of watching her suffer. Aware of this problem, Kakasaw opts to bite the bullet on the question of fatal fetal abnormalities and argues that even in such conditions, abortion is morally unjustifiable. Oh, fucking come on, mate. Come on. If there's a threshold, I mean, that's the threshold, isn't it? Like, we know there's people, like a lot of the people I care for who have, you know, very severe, I don't like the term abnormality because it's very othering, have certain mental, aberrant mental functioning, but who have a very rich life. or a life where they're able to experience a full span, full spectrum of human emotion, but, you know, no brain. It got me thinking, because I've been reading up loads on personhood at the moment, and it and I've got a book back, Dementia, and Dementia, Decision-Making and Personhood. And there's two schools of thought, which is personhood is diminished or lost in dementia. I do not agree with that at all. And then by Tom Kitwood, I'm an adherent of Tom Kitwood's view of dementia care. He thinks that personhood remains. And the first view thinks that personhood resides in cognitive agency. But the second view, the Tom Kitwood one, thinks this attributable to each and every human, regardless of ability. But then it does say that, you know, the narrative agency of people with dementia is constrained in two ways. One, the exclusionary nature of linguistic narrative convention. And number two, the limited opportunities for narrativity. Like what we do all the time, we narrativize our lives. We place ourselves in our forever unfurling story. But then they use this as an example of the degradation of speech when spoken by someone who has advanced dementia. So it starts off as a bad man walked in. Then a beneficent sorcerer pulled the lever, and the bad man was instantaneously inebriated. And by the way, the book House Mother Normal also explores this. It's a really great book by B.S. Johnson, who's one of my favourite authors. Starts off as a testimony from an eyewitness, and gradually it becomes more and more garbled, and it's because it's people witnessing a crime in a care home, and the first person's like a carer, and then progressively they've got neurodegenerative impairment. So the first, a bad man walked in. Yeah, we got that one. And the second one is a splubber walked in, a gingy beebed the yuck, and the splubber was orped. And then the third is ooze splubber fiblo, simu gingy, beebe can yuck, I can splubber orpa. And I realised that's Joyce, mate. That kind of writing has so many similarities to James Joyce, and especially Finnegan's Wake. And there's an entire field of study devoted to seeking coherence and meaning within the dementia of his writing. It also shares some stuff with David Lynch as well. It's in this book, The Twin Peaks, The Return, Critical Essays. It says David Lynch is a world of object vitality. What we said about, or what I'm trying to correct here, which was objectifying, in the literal meaning of objectifying, a baby with anencephaly. I called it a fucking ornament. I called it a vase. I already ruined it on this podcast. I said you could use its head as a pencil case. And seeing other human beings, no matter how limited their cognitive life is, seeing them as objects, very so dehumanizing and horrible. But David Lynch does this a lot in his work. So it's a world of object vitality, meaning objects, they have their own weird kind of agency and sentience, and then human object equality. This is the way you'll hover over objects so that they're imbued with so much meaning. And there's another essay in this book that's really, really good called My Log Has a Message for You, or Vibrant Matter and Twin Peaks on Thing Power and Subjectivity. And I've got the other book called Vibrant Matter which we'll go into in a little bit in a second. That is to say that Lynch's world, that in Lynch's world, objects act as humans do. Humans are often object-like. And there is no distinct hierarchy between the anthropocentric and the inert. You know how his characters can sometimes seem like vessels, or there's not much life to them. They seem almost lobotomized. While this is a thesis which can be applied to and explored in most, if not all, of the cinematic and television landscapes of Lynch's oeuvre, it has never been more central to the understanding of his work than it is in Twin Peaks: The Return. Of course, understanding is a dangerous term to use when discussing Lynch, whose work is often analysed with reference to the director's interest in surrealism, transcendental meditation, the symbolic power of dreams, and the otherwise seemingly obscure products and ventures of the esoteric mindscape. His work is considered deliberately ephemeral, evoking the subconscious imaginings and desires of his characters, his audience, and of Lynch himself through an onslaught of symbols and metaphors delivered by a stream of consciousness narratives that wash over the viewer like music rather than theatre. So, in order to begin to unpack Lynch's adherence to this type of object logic, it'd be useful to first briefly consider the current landscape or object theory, and in particular that of the type advocated by the speculative realists, those whose work forms the bedrock of a contemporary object-oriented philosophy. Like quiddity, I've heard that word used before, like the thingness of something, so the very chairness of chair. The very sweet coolness of sweet corn. That's a recurring trope throughout the book I'm writing, is that the perennial sweet corn who I pray to. And I found that bit of sweet corn under a hoarder sofa, still there years later. And gradually, I've gradually poured a lot of meaning into that corn. Think of it as the faraway God who made the universe and then looked away out the bloody window, looking at John across the road, having a hissy fit over some bolts or car stuff. Speculative realism is a philosophical movement which was conceived in 2007 by a loosely knit collective of philosophers, including Graham Harman, Ray Brazier, Quinten, won't pronounce his second name, I have no idea, Ian Hamilton Grant, who place themselves in opposition to correlationism, which is the idea according to which we only ever have access to the correlation between thinking and being, and never to either term considered apart from the other, a relationship between thinking and being. So we are, I think, therefore I think. I think, therefore I stink. That's how it goes. Correlationism is a defining character, blah, 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 blah. And speculative realists, finding this perspective limited, advocate for an object-oriented ontology, a term coined by Harman in his 1999 doctoral thesis and later adapted as the book Tool Being, Heidegger and the Metaphysics of Objects, and which advocates for the rejection of the privileging of human conception and the investigation of objects as unknowable entities which withdraw from it. To fail to do so, according to Harman, is to either undermine or overmine the object. Using the example of a rock, Harman explains that just as humans do not dissolve into their parents or children, but rather have a certain autonomy from both, so too a rock is neither downwardly reducible to quarks and electrons, not upwardly reducible to its role in stoning the interior ministry. The rock has rock properties not found in its tiny inner components, and also has rock properties not exhausted by its uses. And this works both ways of, it's not necessarily personifying objects, but it's considering them as a being, not necessarily a conscious being, but as a being in some way. And then the opposite of that, which is turning human beings into objects, which people usually do with those who have dementia, like I've said before, about turning them into potted plants. You need to be fed and watered and kept out of direct sunlight. And even though we know that's wrong, I think it's something we can all relate to, but it's whether there's a continuation of that mindset. So for instance, like with this, you know, when I first went into this new residential home to care for the people I care for, because you have no information about what diagnosis they've got, what their care needs are, like who's who. And, you know, you see someone in an electric wheelchair spinning round and around and around. Other person over there, like, yapping like a dog. Other person in, like, there, you know, throwing a mushroom. It's like a room full of broken toys. Because you've no longer, you haven't realized their substance as human beings, and all you're seeing is them reduced down to ticks and triggers and short-circuiting physiological function. But then you start to develop relationships with them, and they come into relief in your eyes, and then you get to know their characters and their interiority and their wants and dislikes and loves and all the, you know, all this kind of good shit. And it's terrible to say, but it's at that point they become human. And it doesn't take long to get there, you know, just a work, one work shift. But when you initially have that disjunct between, that's very dehumanizing, and we have to, you know, eradicate that as quickly as possible. But some people never do. Some people never do. And they're the people who, they can inflict cruelty upon others, and they can commit such overt and horrendous predations. Unfortunately, these are more common than people realize, with like lawyers plugging legal challenges all over the place. And if they're high profile figures, they're surrounded by staff who rely on them to generate and distribute wealth. It's like a clan like system that allows abuse to go unchecked. I don't think it's been a funny episode today, but hopefully it's been enlightening in some ways. I don't know. Just wanted to apply a bit of a corrective. I know that I joke about that stuff with a sense of mischief, but then actually, no matter how I try to theorize it, the target of that joke, if it can even be called that, is a poor little baby who's been born with anencephaly. I'm like, fucking hell, talk about punching down. Is there a target less, what's the word I'm looking for? God, look, some of my fucking brains popped off, popped down the shops today. No, I'm joking. Leslie, is there a target that deserves jokes leveled against them? Any? Oh my God, what is wrong with my brain? No, I spoke about linguistic, you know, linguistic and narrative conventions and you know, grammatical errors and stuff. Yeah, I mean, is dementia contagious? Fucking waffled like this, talking to the Care Collective, a wonderful group of academics, wrote the Care Manifesto, interviewed them for my book, and there were big stretches where I felt I felt like I needed to flex my intellect and prove my vocabulary, but then ended up tripping all over my tongue and my brain. Sorry, we'll end there. Thank you, love you. Oh, Patreon. If you want free episodes, free series on Patreon and all that good stuff, if you want a bit more of me, £3. You've got minimum spend of £3, mate. £3 a month. I'll give you loads of good extra stuff. I'll make it better than this. This wasn't very polished today. Really gnaws it up. And also there'll be a bonus episode again of me and Michael shit chatting and yeah, all that sort of stuff, and so I'll be talking to Mo Omar, brilliant comedian Mo Omar, and Tony Law as well, and for a bonus podcast episode. So thanks again for listening, love you all.